7654321.
You'll never have the sacred stone.
Oh, this you crazy mother.
Welcome, friends, to episode 16 of Color of Magic. I am your host, Daquan Watson, and as usual, riding shotgun, I've got my man, Brian Allen. How you doing?
Hello. It's 16 weeks. We've got a full, almost NFL football season at this point.
Yeah, man. We're making it. We're making it. This has been good. And this is the first time we've had an episode happen in the middle of a preview season or pre-release season. So this is our obligatory pre-release episode, since everybody's got to have those, I guess. Yep.
The thing we got to do.
Yeah, we got to do it. But, you know, we have other news we want to get to first. And I get to pat myself on the back here. Because we somehow completed 60 consecutive days of streaming.
He did.
Which sounds insane when I say it out loud. But being serious, like, I don't know how these people do 365 days. Or like I said, the other person who's got like 2,000 consecutive days.
Yeah, Kokon did 5 years.
Yeah, I don't understand. I really don't. Because 60 was difficult.
Mm-hmm.
I'm getting with another streamer, too. We're talking about possibly doing a co-stream as an AMA in the Just Chatting on Twitch. So people can ask about things I learned and, you know, what could or may not work for different streamers or whatever. But one of my biggest things is just like, I just don't recommend people do it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's hard enough when you have a regular stream schedule and you're prepping stuff to do it every 3 or 4 times a week or whatever. But every night I was trying to come up with variety of stuff to keep people entertained, to try something different without a lot of time to prepare even, you know? So it was definitely different. And it ate up a lot of time. It took up time from other things. I will say that. So, yeah, it was fun. I appreciate it. I met lots of cool people. I got a lot of new followers. I got a lot of subs. I mean, met a lot of cool people even through the chat, and they've been coming in regularly. So that's been great. And
they've been nervous, too, on days like you weren't going to make it, you know.
Yeah. Well, this past week, we had my microphone stand broke apart, or parts of it broke off. I got some food poisoning on Monday morning, which was not good. I mean, it was just in the home stretch. We just got so many hits that really were putting the hurt on us. But we got there.
When we make the Daquan Watson movie, you know, it's going to be that last training montage is going to be epic.
Yeah, I don't even know, man. I was struggling. That'd be the saddest looking training montage. Let me tell you, I got on stream and I was like, beforehand, making sure I got all my sniffles out, and I was like apologizing to people, but you know, they were okay. It went well. People didn't really notice. They were very supportive of my situation. So it was cool. The other cool thing is, though, because I think we mentioned this before, we didn't really time this out when we started the 60-day challenge, but coincidentally, today, day 60, was also the early access Theros release event for streamers. And Wizards of the Coast was kind enough to invite me into their streamer program and let me participate in the early access event. So that was very cool to have that on top of everything else on day 60. So thank you to them for that, because that was very awesome.
Even when Daquan doesn't plan, his plans work out. He's got it like that.
Sometimes. And, you know, I really should have just like owned it, because a couple people just assumed I planned it that way. I should have been like, oh yeah, totally. Yeah. I knew Wizard was going to come through and blah, blah, you know, but no, all of it was coincidental. It was in the air. Once I realized when the day was, I shot Wizards a message and kind of just shot my shot, so to speak. But yeah, everything worked out. So far, so good.
That is awesome. And yeah, they probably thought you planned it too. So, oh, look at this guy. He's really sharp. He's good.
Oh, I'm sure somebody there probably did. Now, another thing I will say, too, is getting to play in that event earlier, man, there have been a lot of crazy, crazy decks and a lot of crazy cards, a lot of powerful cards. So we're going to have a lot to talk about when we get to that part of the stream today.
Yeah, because you have real life experience at this point on this nonsense.
I'm not going to lie to you. After playing, I did change one of my choices.
I was wondering about that.
I wasn't going to, but then I was like, eh, I like this card enough that I'm changing one of my choices.
Corrupt Morgan, he's had actual experience. I am totally spitballing. These are just blatant guesses on my part.
That is totally fair. That is completely fair. And to be fair, I've only really played 2 hours worth. I got on from noon to 2 today, and I played a couple of hours just to kind of be part of it, let people know what's going on. And then I'm going to be on for my normal time tonight from 9 p.m. to midnight. So granted, this is all after the fact because I will already be finished by the time people listen to this. But all my regular viewers will get to see it. So I want to make sure, because, I mean, it wouldn't make sense to really have the people help me get today 60 and then abandon them on the cool day, because that would suck.
And I will say, you know, for stuff, you know, when you're wrong, I find the 2 hours is enough time to figure out this card I thought was good really blows. I was totally right. That's been my experience.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So one of the things I wanted to share this week on, I guess, our What Did We Learn Last Week segment was that it's really sad to me how many people sound like they want to make a living in some way, shape, or form playing video games, whether that's streaming, competitive play, you know, whatever. But they don't make the efforts to market or brand themselves or appropriately promote in any way. And it's really, really almost disappointing because some of them, I think, have the personality or have the resources, but just either don't make the effort or don't see the importance of it. So you see them streaming and getting like 5 viewers, or you see them like going to all these events to participate, but they're not linking up with any teams or doing anything else. And it's just, I think people have to what I realized through the 60 days and all my research is that people don't do enough to treat the gaming industry they want to be part of as a for real job and business if they want to really make a living at it.
So true.
Because even in 60 days, which again, I'm going to have a bunch more to share when we get that stream lined up, but there was so much I came in with that I thought I knew or didn't know for various reasons, and some was true, some was not. But the things I learned seemed to be very simple, but I was surprised how many people weren't doing them. So that's what I learned, that I think we still have a long way to grow from the business side. And I don't mean like the big business side. Like when you're talking about the ninjas of the world that are making, you know, several million dollars a year and whatever, like I'm not worried about those people. I'm talking about on the lower end, the people that maybe not going to make, you know, 60-70k a year, but they could probably work themselves to a point where they can make 35-45k a year, you know, and that would be attainable for a lot of people, I believe. But anyway, like I said, I'm gonna go deeper on that another time. But what did you learn last week?
Well, I think just to my shock and a lot of other people's, I guess I don't know if I can say I'm shocked, the Oscars still don't seem to get it.
Yeah, that's true. I saw a lot of that going around.
I thought after, you know, the year we're okay, Black Panther, like, okay, the Oscars, you know, are going to recognize diversity. This is a watershed moment. No, it was not that. It was 1 year where they actually saw some movies that people of color actually were involved in and saw, and we're right back to Oscar so white.
Yeah, and I don't even know what to say to that, man. I mean, it feels like one of those things that would be more obvious by now, but I don't know. I mean, same thing. There's been a lot of going around about women directors not even being nominated.
Yeah, with obvious misses, like Greta Gerwig. How does that happen? Because you can't say it was a year where, like, okay, you know, there weren't any really good movies featuring women or people. You can't say that at all.
Yeah, there were options. I mean, you're right. I mean, I get it in years where there's like one or two and you would feel like you're doing it just because. But when there's several to pick from,
yeah,
like, yeah, you're probably not doing the best you could do there.
I'm still so mad about Dolomite. That's just my, if I could recommend one movie that the Academy probably didn't see, please, people, see Dolomite.
I have to tell you, I only saw two clips of that movie.
What are the reviews?
And it's on my list now that I'm done with the 60-day stuff. It's one of the first things I'm going to watch on Netflix.
I thought that one had such a great chance because usually the Academy loves movies about the movie-making process. That's how, you know, stuff like Once Upon a Time in Hollywood comes out there. I will be perfectly honest. I have not seen Once Upon a Time in Hollywood yet. But, I mean, I love Quentin Tarantino. I'm sure it's a well-done movie. Brad Pitt, Leonardo DiCaprio. You knew it was going to be a huge, you know, that one. And, of course, the second we found out Tom Hanks is playing Mr. Rogers, it's like, okay, best actor goes to. Everybody else competing for whatever awards there are out there.
But even then, I mean, you know, here we are getting on movie talk, but like Dolomite also serves as kind of a comeback movie for Eddie Murphy.
Yeah, and he's kind of, you know, he doesn't like it when you call it that, but it absolutely is.
And you know what's wild? I looked back, he only has the one, I think, and that was for the Dreamgirls.
Yeah. And the joke is that he didn't get that one because Norbit came out right when the Oscars dropped. And like, okay, yeah, we can't give you an award. And you made, even though I think all the things are decided way before, you know, the show actually happens. They would have to be.
Yeah.
That was the joke. Anyway.
I have no idea about their process.
At this point, it seems like a lot, although there apparently was, I think it was a great article about Hoop Dreams, which is another documentary that all the critics just assumed Hoop Dreams is going to, at the very least, you know, would get a lot of buzz. And now they apparently did a whole campaign where people purposely were giving it a zero out of whatever their number is just to make sure it didn't win. Oh, wow.
That's sad.
It's a prime example of the Academy. I mean, how are you going to give it a zero? I get it. It's not your favorite, but they were purposely weighting it so it stood no chance of winning, even if a couple of other people voted for it.
Well, our learnings aside.
Yep. Because we go on forever about, you know, our movie.
Oh, you know what that? They started the construction again.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Actually, it's really loud this time, though. You know what that means, though? We have some Banhammer action that happened.
And it's at least one of the usual suspects.
Yeah, so this scene, I don't know, maybe we brought it with us when we started doing this dang show, but Oko's at it again.
Yeah. I'm sorry, Oko.
So Monday, Wizards of the Coast announced another round of bannings, this time for Modern. And we got three cards on the list. The first one, Oko, Thief of Crowns, I think everybody is okay with.
Yeah,
we all figured it was coming. I you know, and we talked about this a little bit. Like, is this the point where we start just saying Oko is one of the most powerful cards in Magic of all time?
He's the GOAT.
I mean, sir, like, this is crazy. Like, we had a point in time where we used to think, like, Jace the Mind Sculptor was too strong. And people even made funny songs about Jace being most powerful of all or whatever. Or better than all, right, was the thing. But now we're looking at Oko, and Oko's been banned nearly across the board.
And it only took,
3 months.
It wasn't even a long minute. Yeah.
But that's crazy, right? Like, that has to put it in that top tier category. Like, we can't deny this now.
No. And again, it's just wild how, you know, once more people get a hold of it and start playtesting it, just how things get worked.
Now, the other card, well, I say other, there were two. One of the other cards on the list was Mycosynth Lattice. Now, this card causes problems because, obviously, in the way people play it in Modern, is you play Karn lets you go search for an artifact from outside the game, you get one out of your sideboard, you bring the Mycosynth Lattice in, and Karn's other ability is that you can't activate artifacts, which, when Mycosynth Lattice turns everything into artifacts, well, that's no good for you.
So is Karn going to survive this? Does he have enough without that combo to still
Yeah, I think Karn's fine. I think the way it works out, really, is that it's more about the play patterns and kind of the general feeling around what is created when the Mycosynth Lattice Karn situation happens. Right? Because it's not any good to be on camera and have that happen and the game's just over, effectively.
Yeah.
Like, even if it takes 6 or 7 more turns for the lattice player to get their cards, they need to kill you. Like, you're really just kind of sitting there and twiddling your thumbs till it happens.
Michael Myers is coming, and Laurie's not here to get you. You just go die now.
Yeah, and I would even say the casual to mid-level players, which is a big chunk of the modern community, they just, it's kind of like even when like Emrakul stole your turn or anything else. Like, this is in that ballpark where like it just makes people want to scoop and quit.
Which, again, not good for TV.
It's not good for business. So, though I don't think this was, like, it was really powerful and really strong. I don't know if it was format warping, but it was enough of a problem that they felt the need to deal with it. And though people don't necessarily agree with it from a power level, people don't seem to be too upset about it.
It was fun warping, if nothing else.
Yeah. Now, the third card is one we can have a discussion about. Mox Opal ended up on the ban list. And
yeah, Magic Twitter, a lot of it was not happy.
Well, yeah, because a lot of people feel like Mox Opal is in some ways paying for the sins of Urza. And they may be partially right. I can't say totally, but you're in a weird spot because, you know, Mox Opal's had tipped over the $100 mark for a little bit.
Yeah, and I mean, and you know, if you were in a situation where, you know, to compete or to build a deck, you felt like you had to buy them, you know.
Yeah, but at the same time, Mox Opal's been on everybody's kind of like watch list, if you want to call it that, for a while now. Yeah. Like, we've had multiple bannings go by where people are like, well, is Mox Opal this time? Nope, it's still here. Is Mox Opal this time? Nope, still here. So I do get people being mad that, you know, if you spent $300 or $400 on Mox Opals or traded a bunch of cards to get them and now they're banned in your favorite format, I get it. That sucks. Also sucks if, you know, you played it in a different deck that wasn't Urza and it just makes your deck weaker. I get it.
It also didn't help that a lot of the players, you know, came off as kind of elitist. Like, well, if you can't afford $400 for Mox Opals, you probably shouldn't be playing in this format.
Yeah, that's a whole different thing. Like, it's not even about that. Sometimes you can afford to spend it and you just don't want to have to take a beating on something you just spent $400 on. Yeah. But like I said, the problem, though, is this is a card we knew could be gone at any point. So unless you were brand new, you kind of knew that this was a thing that could happen. Even if it wasn't this banning, it might have been the next one or the following one. But it's been floating under the radar just barely for a long time.
That's the thing, you know, that CCGs have that frustrates you that most other, you know, pastimes or hobbies, if you will. Like if I go to bowling tournaments, which a lot of people in my family do, they're not going to ban my bowling ball, you know, or my favorite lane or anything generally.
Yeah, but I think that's something we just know is part of the culture. It's part of the process and we have to live with it. Now, people have asked me particularly, yep, like, do I agree with these bannings? I think Oko, no problem. Mycosynth Lattice, no problem. Mox Opal, I get it. So I'm not like, Mox Opal's one I'm not really for or against, but I'd just as soon see Urza gone anyway with it. Like, if they would have went as a pair, yeah, I would have probably been happier. But as it is, it's fine.
And since we started talking about finance, and we do that a little bit on this show, like, how do you, because you, I'm sure, have far more cards than what I do. When you start hearing, you know, possibility of the banhammer, how do you treat that? Do you get rid of them all? Do you keep a few? How do you handle that?
I usually hold on to what I need to play with. Like, if I think I'm ever going to play, because I, at this point, I've played Magic long enough that I already know my personal play styles. So there are some decks I know I will never play. Like, the Urza deck, no matter how popular it was, I knew I was never going to play that in a tournament. Like, it's just not something I would enjoy playing for, well, if I played in a Grand Prix, you know, that I'd have to play for, like, 16 rounds or something. Like, just, it's not my jam. But in those cases, I would just trade or sell whatever parts came up, and I wouldn't worry about it. If it's a deck that I, or cards that I may eventually play with, or certain lands I want to have, maybe for a commander deck or something, then I hold on to them. And I hold on to what I think I'll need. I don't hold extras. If anything, I may put like a spare fifth copy or something in a trade binder or trade box just to have when I go to the local shops and have some trade fodder when I need to build a deck last minute. But otherwise, I don't really worry about it too much. I really don't. Okay. I mean, I do most of my pickups through like collection buying or whatever. So, I mean, that or I build up store credit that I use at different places to get stuff. Like right now, not even exaggerating, I think I have store credit at like 5 stores up here in this area. Or, well, 4 stores and an actual IOU for $20. Seriously, I'm not even joking. So the price of individual cards doesn't really matter to me greatly because I feel like if I need it, I need it for a certain reason. If I need it for a tournament or I'm building a deck, and usually when I build a deck, like I'll often play a deck for a whole standard season. Or if I build, say, a modern or a commander deck or something, I just leave the decks together for 9 months at a time. So even if I'm not playing regularly or playing that deck even like once a week or whatever, I'm getting my money's worth out of whatever I put into that anyway. So for me personally, price doesn't matter greatly. I understand it's just part of the game. Prices fluctuate a bunch. I mean, sometimes I may find spots where I can speculate because I think a card's better than the price is saying it is. And that happens. But otherwise, yeah, not much. I mean, a good example is, I guess, we'll be touting my social media streams here a little bit. But Monday night, we went through a collection. We did a collection review. I bought a $1,500 collection from a local guy. Went through it. And there was a bunch of good cards in there, but I literally looked at them and went, you know what? I'm probably going to sell most of these, whether it's on eBay or just selling them to like the local vendor or something. Cards I have already plenty of, but I will still make more than my money back just getting rid of them to vendors and selling them through other channels. So I'm not motivated to hold on to them. Now, there's a few that I'm like, this might have more room to go up in value, or I only have 3. I'll keep a 4th copy or whatever, fill out a collection. But I didn't do it based on the value of the card. I just decided, do I need that one or not? If the answer is yes, I hold it. If not, it's getting sold.
There you go. A little magic science and knowledge from DQ.
Yeah, it's a big roundabout answer there. But so yeah, anyway, we told everybody this was going to be our Theros episode because, you know, this is the time and everybody's doing it. So either from beginning last week all the way through this week, everybody's putting their Theros episodes up. And we wanted to approach it from a different perspective because everybody's talking about like, what are the best cards? Some people are reviewing every single card because, you know, it's just what they do. And ours is more about being different and having personality over here. So we decided to go with some different categories and then we each independently chose cards within those categories. So we're picking 3 each. And then for the final category, we're picking 1 card. And we are effectively going to make our cases for why we feel or believe the cards fit these categories. Hopefully that's a little more entertaining for people to listen to.
And again, we haven't compared, so we don't, this is the first time we're hearing each other's picks. We don't know if we pick the same card or not on any of these.
Oh, that's true. I think it's going to be more funny if we pick some of the cards for different categories, but this also comes by way of some of the feedback we got through Twitter and through our Discord, where a few people came through and just like, hey, we'd like to hear this. We just want to hear your perspectives. And it was neat because nobody really wanted to see or listen to another 3-hour set review. So that was good. That part of the market is saturated. Thank goodness. So first category is just what we found to be most interesting cards. I will start to make it easy. But my number one in this category was Archon of Sun's Grace. For those of you that don't know, this is the Pegasus. Well, it's an Archon that has flying and lifelink. It's 2 colorless, 2 white. And Pegasus creatures you control have lifelink. It has constellation. Whenever an enchantment enters a battlefield under your control, you get a 2/2 white Pegasus creature token with flying. And it's a 3/4. So for 4 mana, you get a 3/4 flying lifelink thing that gives all other Pegasus lifelink, but you get to generate Pegasus, which is cool. One, because this sort of functions as a Pegasus Lord, which is kind of cool.
Yeah.
I also like the fact that it works, and it gives you more motivation to play the enchantment-based decks, which is neat because obviously the set has a ton of enchantments or enchantment creatures. So that works. And it works really neat with the other card, Divine Visitation, from, I think it was Guilds of Ravnica. But it's the enchantment that whenever you have a token come into play, instead you get a 4/4 Flying Angel. So you swap your Pegasus for Angels, and now the deck's even more powerful.
Okay.
Now, if anybody's going to do it, that's a different story. Is that competitive? I have no idea. But I think it's just cool having something that targets a new creature type. You get a new tribe that you can try to build towards, or you can just build this crazy enchantment-based thing that does something entirely different. So,
because if they put enchantment on every card, it has to take off, right? If they just do an entire set where everything is enchantment, 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 it has to be competitive in theory.
But yeah, I think when there's just that many enchantments, like, it's a card that's really interesting to see if somebody will build around, but I don't know if they will. So ultimately, it's a neat card. I put it in the category of interesting because it has enough things that are different and opens up some opportunities for other stuff.
I feel like at some point I'll play it just because, you know, I'm the tribal guy. So if there's a new tribe, I'm going to try it at least once.
Go for it.
And even if it's bad, I'll probably still play it for way longer than I should to try to make it work.
So what's the first thing you picked for this category?
Thassa's Oracle. And I want to say blue is my least played color by far. If I get the quest, you know, play a bunch of blue cards, I usually reset it. It's a 2 blue mana Merfolk Wizard. When it enters the battlefield, look at the top X cards of your library, where X is your devotion to blue. You put one of them on top of your library, the rest on the bottom in random order. And if X is greater than or equal to the number of cards in your library, you win the game, which is really the part, you know, I love crazy win cons and stuff. So that's a different thing for blue.
Yeah.
You do this thing and you win. So I'm interested to see, because obviously blue has a lot of ways to, you know, draw insane amounts of cards and stand there and do nothing for a while. So getting the devotion in theory should be a doable thing.
Well, you know, the self-mill decks are already a thing, so this kind of fits into those.
And even if you don't get the win condition for 2 mana, it does a lot, seems like.
That is true. 2 mana could let you look at, hell, 10 cards.
Yeah. Then stack your deck a little bit. And it's a 1/3, so, you know, it's a decent blocker also.
Yeah, that's true. Even if you have to play it early, because it's still going to be minimum devotion 2 by itself if you play it on turn 2. What's funny is the second card I have in this category on my list is also a blue card. Okay. I went with Nader Kraken. It is colorless blue-blue. Creature type Kraken. Whenever you draw a card, you may pay 1. If you do, put a +1/+1 on Nader Kraken and create a 1/1 blue tentacle creature token. And it's a 2/3. Now, first off, I think I'm going to follow the sentiment of a lot of other people, is this is not free reign for everybody to make custom tentacle tokens, y'all.
Oh, God. Yeah. Yeah. That could go bad real fast.
We're just going to use the stock tentacle tokens that come in the boosters. That's it. Let's call it good.
It's sad we have to tell people this, but yeah.
Now, with that aside, this is a pretty cool card because over the course of 4 or 5 turns, you could end up with like a 5-power creature and 3 extra dudes. It's one of those things, like, if you don't deal with it early, it could get out of hand.
Yeah.
And it's not a real small, like, a 2/3 is reasonable, right? There's a lot of things you can block with that if you have to in the early couple of turns even. So depending on what you're playing against, you could really cause some problems for the opponent. But what I was thinking about is, in those matchups, say the blue-white mirror match or whatever, where you're playing control on control, this card could be okay.
Yeah.
Because they're not going to have a ton of removal. I mean, do they leave removal in just to deal with your Kraken? Like, maybe. I mean, Banishing Lights, I guess. But it's a neat card. I like, conceptually, the idea of this, like, there's the Kraken, but then you see, like, oh, there's this tentacle and this tentacle, and it's grabbing things, and, you know, and it looks like it's getting bigger as it's coming out of the water. And it's like, so it's a cool way to depict the idea of the Kraken on a small card. Because usually you get like a Kraken, it like costs six or something and does something silly or whatever, right? But we actually got one that's normally costed that you could possibly put into a deck. It just grows to big size and doesn't start that way.
Go, go, Cthulhu.
So what do you got for your second card in the most interesting category?
I did see where I didn't know we were doing three for
each one. See, I must not have seen that in the Well, I can give you my third in that category while you are looking.
Okay.
But I went with Storm's Wrath. Mostly because, well, let me give you the text on that first. It's a two colorless red. It's a sorcery. Storm's Wrath deals four damage to each creature and each planeswalker. And the reason I find this card interesting is it's not often we get cards like this that, like, I mean, we have other stuff, but it's usually like gold cards, or they do just like they cost five and do five damage to everything. But this one is actually like reasonable that four damage is enough to get rid of most creatures. May not get rid of all planeswalkers, but it does a good job toward that. But I think what we're looking at is, does this change what control decks look like? Like right now, they're kind of splashing some white or splashing some red or doing this other thing. But like traditionally, we think of control decks as being largely blue-white or being something like blue-based. But
yeah,
does that change here? Like, do we move to a red, white, control-ish type deck now that we have Storm's Wrath and you have Banishing Light and you have a couple of planeswalkers you could potentially kill with? Like, you could play some super slow control style deck where you're killing with big Chandra and just giving them the one damage emblem every turn. It's like, I don't know. Like, it's a thing. I don't know if we get there or not, but it's really, really interesting to think about. Like, I don't know what this leads to, but I think it's a cool card. I don't know. Again, I don't know if it's going to be the centerpiece to anything, but I like what the potential is there for it to create, which is really neat.
And that's what this category is about. You know, these are things that, hey, they pique your interest. They might not end up being, you know, a huge... Everything doesn't have to be competitive. Some stuff is just, you know, fun. You try it, you run it at the flagpole, see if it sails, so to speak.
Yeah, that's exactly it. Like, I'm not looking to pick the most powerful thing. I mean, I think we know a lot of the powerful cards in the set. I mean, people are talking about them left and right. If you watch any of the streams on Wednesday, like, you'll see powerful cards in action. But I'm looking at, like, what are some of the things that could get there, or some things that may be impactful later that we're not seeing a lot of?
And I have to remind people, he was, you know, he was dead on Embercleave, so you might want to listen to this man.
You know, I think as a dude, an old guy once told me at a poker table, said even a blind squirrel finds an acorn. So, you know.
I was waiting for you to say you had to know when to hold him or know when to fold him. It's like, you talked to Kenny Rogers? I was like, but no, it was...
No, well, you know, you say that. I have some stories. I'll just say that for another time.
I'll bet.
But yeah, so our next category, or do you have another one you want to put into the interesting category?
Yeah, I do have one, because, you know, again, tribal stuff, and I'm going to probably massacre this pronunciation, but Chainweb Arachnir, I think is what it's saying.
Okay, yeah.
One green spider with reach, and you know, I know it's a spider with reach. Wait, listen, there's more. Whenever it enters the battlefield, it does damage equal to its power to target creature with flying, and it's got escape. So the escape is a three with two green. And then once it escapes, it gets three more counters. So it's, you know, I'm not saying spider tribal is taking over, but it's interesting. It's, you know, the first spider I've seen in a while where it's like, this doesn't seem completely terrible. I might actually put this in a deck.
I mean, there have been some other spiders recently that were playable, but I don't know if we've had enough of them at one time that you could do something with. And this set also has the other spider that makes more spiders.
That was actually going to be the next one I was going to talk about. Is the now I got to pull it up here.
So yeah, there's definitely options there.
Yeah, At some point, I tried the spider deck, and we see what it does. Because green's got enough creatures to where you can just throw other random things in there that are huge and kill everything, and the spiders had to having to probably do minimal work.
Oh, sure.
But when it kills, you know, that giant dragon that you need getting gotten rid of, like, good job, spider. You're a good creepy crawly. And plus, my son really just loves spiders more than, which I guess for a 13-year-old boy, loving spiders is actually pretty normal. Now
that I think about it. Yeah, that's not that odd. If it's not spiders, it's snakes.
Now, if he doesn't like to actually see them, but, you know, spiders in movies or...
Okay. Well, that's a home family pick then.
Yeah.
The other spider you're looking for is Arasta of Precisely. The Endless Web.
Almost like a spider god kind of. Legendary enchantment creature, reach. Whenever an opponent casts an instant or a sorcery, create a 1/2 green spider token with reach. So, you know, that's going against, of course, our probably natural enemy, blue. Going to be dropping a lot of instant and sorceries and just, okay,
yep.
More spiders.
Yeah, and it is interesting that the other Chainweb Arachnir is a one-cost creature. So there are some situations, especially, let's say, like mono-white ends up getting popular and they're playing enough one-cost flyers, that could be worth it to play the Chainweb instead of something like Pelt Collector, even in some of the Gruul decks, and just give you a way to block some of those creatures, and then later on, you get this 4-5 creature that you get out of the yard, so that could be kind of cool.
And of course, there's all kinds of ridiculously cool things for, you know, green devotion. So,
yeah, definitely some opportunity there. Okay, moving on to cards we think will have an impact. My three here, I think, are nice. Actually, two are nice, but I'll lead with the one that I think is probably going to, if somebody was judging my choices, this is the one that will probably get the most hate.
We're all judging.
That's fine. I've been judged before. I will continue to be judged, I am sure. But I'm going with Heliod's Intervention. It's X white white instant. Choose one. Destroy X target artifacts and or enchantments, or target player gains twice X life. The reason I put this card in my list is, one, is I'm pretty sure nobody's going to be looking at it right now. And this isn't a card I think is going to be, you know, like a four of in any deck list. But I can see a lot of situations where decks would play one and maybe one in the side or maybe two in the sideboard. Because knowing how many enchantments or artifacts there are going to be, instant speed, like during somebody's end step, being able to spend, let's say, 5 mana and just kill off 3 things is huge. Like, and not only that, like in this format, you could be killing off creatures with that, potentially. And we know at a minimum, people have been playing stuff like Banishing Light, Shadow Spear. I mean, hell, you can use it to get rid of an Embercleave at instant speed. I mean, there are a lot of things this card does. And of all of them, of the interventions, this is the one that kind of stood out to me that people don't seem to really be talking about, but really has possibly some implications for competitive play here. And the gain life portion is okay, but I don't think that's going to be huge unless you're playing against a lot of red decks or something. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, I'm sure on some level, the other interventions will show up somewhere. But like the other one, you know, like Nihilus Intervention, you get to search for X lands, which I'm sure with all these decks, I can produce a ton of mana. Somebody will play it. You know, looking at the top X card your library with that Thassa's Intervention, that's got to be worth something. And you get to keep two of them. So blue decks may play one or two of those. But for some reason, and maybe people are talking about it, but I just haven't seen people mention Heliod's Intervention. I don't think the card's going to be crazy expensive, but I could see this being a solid like $2, $3 card that people are playing in a lot of their decks. Because if I'm playing mono white or if I'm playing like blue white, there's a chance I want to have this card available to me. But yeah, that's just my thoughts. Like I said, I will be trying out a couple just to see what happens. So what else you got in this category?
Pretty obvious pick, Grey Merchant of Asphodel, because it was good, you know, last time we did Theros. It almost single-handedly makes mono black devotion a thing.
Man, talk about taking the low-hanging fruit.
Of course, it already goes into a deck that I run with, you know, my Black Knights, because, okay, you play Gray Merchant, Smitten Swordmaster, my pick from last time that actually did turn into a halfway decent card. Mono Black almost doesn't ever have to attack. You just lay creatures down, and probably Revenge of Ravens, and it's almost like a red deck. Your opponent is dead, and you haven't ever actually turned a card sideways.
You know, it's funny how our picks sort of lean into each other, because my next pick is also a black card.
Okay.
And it's Nightmare Shepherd. This card is two colorless, black-black, enchantment creature demon, flying. When another non-token creature you control dies, you may exile it. If you do, create a token that's a copy of that creature, except it's a 1/1 and it's a nightmare in addition to its other types. So that's a lot of words on this card to begin with, and it's a 4/4. If you exile a thing, you basically get a card that has all the same text as the card you removed, but it's a 1/1 nightmare instead. So this is really interesting, especially if you get, well, at its bare minimum, this card actually gives you some little bit of protection from board sweepers. Because all your other creatures will come back as 1/1s just with all the abilities that they had. Then, if you have, say, like Ayara out, the black card that when you play a creature, you drain your opponent for one, you can tap her and sacrifice a token, or sacrifice a black creature to draw a card. Well, this lets you use Ayara to sack a thing. You can exile the thing and then get another token, which is going to drain your opponent for one, and you get the card. Now you have something else you can also sack. Like, it's really interesting the cards it works with and the things that it does. Not to mention that it has two black mana symbols in its cost, which helps with their devotion for other things as well.
Black is looking really strong.
Yeah, there's a lot happening with this card. I think it's a little underrated by a few people. But at bare minimum, on rate, it's a 4-mana 4/4 that flies. And that alone is reasonable. But it has a really good ability. I mean, it can even make some combats look bad for your opponent, knowing, like, if they block certain things, well, some stuff has enter the battlefield triggers. So do you want to kill that, knowing that a potential copy is going to come down and do a thing? It's really, really strong of a card. And I think it's definitely gone underappreciated here in the early weeks, but it's a card I'm definitely going to be giving a second look to. And I expect, of the cards on my list, like, this is probably going to have the most immediate impact, because I think it's going to show up in several mono black lists.
Yeah, I'm hyped.
Do you have another one in this category?
I do, and again, it's low-hanging fruit. It's going to appear on pretty much everybody's list, I think, but Bronzehide Lion just seems like it's going to be just a super annoying thing to deal with.
Okay, I don't think that's the most, like, low-hanging thing. I'm willing to hear you out on this.
Of course, obviously, it already has a Selesnya shell that it fits into pretty much perfectly with green and white.
Mm-hmm.
And then in addition to our enchantment theme, you know, when you finally figure out a way to kill it, it comes back as an enchantment and makes something else invulnerable. So it's going to be, I mean, you're just going to keep getting hit for three, possibly, unless you figure out a way to deal with this thing.
I do also like the idea that if you're playing something that triggers from enchantments coming into play, this dying technically gives you another trigger and some things that can happen.
Exactly. This is going to be so much, you know, graveyard stuff. Graveyard hate, I think, is going to have to be a thing you at least have in your sideboard, because there are so many things that are designed to not die or bounce back.
I will say, I considered briefly, and I didn't have time to put into the list, but it's still on my mind to maybe produce, if possible, a Naya-based list that's playing, like, the Bronzehide Lion, Xur'Tog Goblin, Spellbreaker, maybe the knight that lets you choose one of three things, but particularly to get to play the Biobox card from, I don't know if it was last set or the set before, but it was from the set before, at least, because the last one was the king or whatever, the white card. But what I was thinking, it's the angel that pumps multicolor creatures, but when a multicolor creature dies, it goes back to your hand. And I was like, that could be really cool, being able to play that with all multicolor things. Not to mention you have the artifact that pumps multicolor creatures by one. Like there's a bunch of things in that space that I really want to kind of experiment with. It may just be weaker than just playing straight up other versions, but definitely something I would give some time to. But no, I think you're onto something. Like Bronze-Eyed Lion, that's fair. If that showed up on some list, I would not be surprised. Like that's, I don't think that's a slam dunk, but I think it's got something going on there. The last one I have for this category was Phoenix of Ash. And the reason is because I think it fits into a few different decks. Now, I don't know which one it ultimately takes its home up in. That remains to be seen. But for those of you who don't know, okay, so the text on Phoenix of Ash, it's colorless red-red, creature type Phoenix, has flying and haste. For two and a red, the Phoenix gains +2/+0 to end of turn. It has escape, two colorless red-red, exile three other cards from your graveyard. And when it escapes with a +1/+1 counter, and it's a 2/2 creature. So generally speaking, for 3 mana, you get a 2/2 flying haste creature that if you have 3 mana available, you can pump its power by 2. So that in and of itself isn't huge, but the fact that it has haste allows it to fit into several types of creature shells. If you want to play like low to the ground mono red, so you have an evasive attacker. If you want to play it in Gruul potentially as another cheap card that goes over the top. Also, the turn after you play it, you have enough to pump it at least. So it's going to be a 4/2 flyer, if nothing else. And then late game, if you get it back into play, it's 3 damage, which a lot of times is going to be straight up 3 damage unblockable. Like say your opponent sweeps the board even on turn 4 or 5 and it gets swept up with some other creatures. Well, the next turn, you just escape, get rid of those other cards in your yard and attack for 3. So it's got a lot of use to it. I think it could be pretty interesting. Like I said, I don't know ultimately what deck or where it takes up its home, but I would not be surprised if I lose a game or two to the Phoenix of Ash.
Unlike you, I don't know exactly where it goes, but I wouldn't be surprised to see it turn up somewhere.
Yeah, it's going to be somewhere, and I'm not going to be shocked when it happens. But, you know, that's Magic. I will say this, too, about Theros. There are a lot of cool cards in this set. Like,
definitely.
This is one of the sets where I look and think, you know, there a lot of these rares and mythics especially, and that's not even to say probably like 10 or 15 of the commons and uncommons, but a lot of these cards are going to find homes in a lot of decks. I think these first 3 weeks are going to be the experimentation where you're going to see a lot of stuff get played. All right, on to our category that I really like, our most fun cards. So for me, the first one here is easy, and it's Purphoros Bronze-Blooded. Now, I know on first glance, people be like, well, what's fun about that card? But just hear me out for a second, because Purphoros Bronze-Blooded, 4 colorless and a red, legendary enchantment creature god, indestructible, god text as long as your devotion to red is less than 5, Purphoros isn't a creature. Other creatures you control have haste. For 2 colorless and a red, you may put a red card or an artifact card from your hand onto the battlefield, sacrifice it at the beginning of the next end step. So that's a lot of things. But
yeah,
other than the fact that he does cost a little bit, which is fine, he does give all your other creatures haste, which is pretty good. And there's a good chance that by the time you play him, it's going to be pretty easy to turn it into a creature, and he's a 7/6, which is big. But what I like about it, and listen, in commander play for sure, this thing has a lot of uses. But even for constructed play, like this allows you to build some decks where you get to play with some big honking creatures that you wouldn't necessarily play with.
And yeah, that's fun. That's why I play.
That's always interesting to me. Like, I'm going to die because during my end step, somebody with Purphoros is going to put in the big double strike dragon or something. Then on their turn, play another creature with 2 red symbols in the cost, and then attack with like Big Dumb Dragon, whatever the new thing is, Purphoros, and I'm going to take like 88 damage. Yeah, and I'm okay with that. I think that's cool. If I lose that way because somebody took the gamble and played overcosted things or whatever and snuck them into play, like I'm all about it. I don't see anything wrong with that. So yeah, easily made my most fun list.
Definitely.
So what do you got?
I got a Hydra's Growth, because like we were just talking about, as we said, our cards kind of lean into each other, talking about making big honking creatures.
Yeah.
And it's another enchantment, because hey, that's it. I'm going in on the enchantments if nobody else is. When it enters the battlefield, it costs 3 green, by the way, or well, 2 and 1 green. When Hydra's Growth enters the battlefield, put a 1/1 counter on the enchanted creature. And at the beginning of your upkeep, you double the number 1/1 counter. So you're going to have to answer this pretty quick, or it's going to get out of hand.
Yeah, and I like that. You know, it's one of those things that, okay, cool. You have a couple counters on it. Great. It's like, oh, well, now you have 4 counters on it. Oh, okay, now you have 8 counters on it.
And of course, it's not like green doesn't already have a ton of things to generate counters.
Yeah, I agree. I think this
is something that could be, you know, 10-10 on turn 3 or 4 easily.
Yeah, and it's a type of card, again, I think, especially in a commander situation, if you even played that on turn 3 or 4, like if it doesn't get dealt with in 2 turns, like you now have a very threatening creature, which is funny because my next card was also a green enchantment. My card was Mantle of the Wolf. What's funny, I'm going to tell you, honest truth, my notes here next to Mantle of the Wolf say, go big and still get home. Like, not go big or go home, but like, you can go big and still get there if they get rid of your big creature.
I was looking at that one. It almost made my list.
Yeah, it's 3 colors and a green. Aura enchantment, or enchantment aura, depending, I guess, how you read the card. Enchanted creature gets +4/+4. When Mantle of the Wolf is put into a graveyard from the battlefield, create 2/2/2 green wolf creature tokens. This thing is great, man.
It's already got a deck that it fits into perfectly.
Well, I'll tell you this. I played a couple this morning, and I wanted more in my deck.
Okay.
I mean, being able to turn even like a junky turn 1 or turn 2, like Pelt Collector or Paradise Druid, into a 5 or 6 power attacker is huge. And then if they do anything to remove your creature, well, the mantle also falls off because there's no creature. It goes to the graveyard, and then you get 2 dudes. Like, this card's really nice, man. Like,
and again, wolves are already a thing, so it's got a home.
And this falls in that slot of being both powerful and fun, in the sense that, like, you get big creatures and just get to not have to worry about your opponent sweeping the board. So if, like, you like attacking with creatures, this is the card for you. Because even if they deal with your thing, you're like, okay, fine, I don't care, you have Death Touch, I'm going to take your dude out, and now I have 2 more dudes. Like, it's real nice. I'm a big fan. And what's cool is this card doesn't get exiled to get you the 2 wolves. Like, it literally just dies, goes to the yard, you get 2 things. So anything that needs something in the graveyard still gets benefited. Anything that has come into play triggers from creatures gets benefited. Like, this card for 4 mana surprisingly does a lot. I don't know if it becomes a staple card that, you know, green decks will be playing, but I like it. I'm in.
And it's so thematic because you don't ever get to fight 1 wolf. You fight 1 wolf and the whole pack shows up.
Also true. I didn't really think about that, but that's very true. Maybe that's why I made sure you got at least 2 wolves out of the deal. So what else do you have in your most fun category?
Well, in keeping with my combo with the Hydra's Growth, you know, things that get counters, Setessan Champion.
Okay, yeah.
Gets a counter, you know, every time you play an enchantment, because, well, that's what we're doing this set, apparently, is playing the enchantments.
Yeah.
So every time an enchantment enters the battlefield, you get a 1/1 counter on him. So you can easily, you know, put the Hydra's Growth on him, and now you've got, okay, you're going to answer this or the game is over. And you draw a card every time you play an enchantment.
Yeah, that's true. Because a lot of in the previous Theros set, when you got bonuses, it was just like, oh, okay, you get whatever till end of turn, or you get a +1/+1 counter. Like, this is getting you a counter and a card. Like, that's got to be considered.
Which is very likely an enchantment, and you just keep, because that's how, you know, just to kind of curiously see how this might work, I built a knight deck that runs, you know, the knight enchantments, and I'd say at least probably 60% of my opponents had nothing to get rid of enchantments, and you just, at that point, you got a good chance to steamroll. Now, this set, I'm thinking people will be more concerned about that, but just looking at the field before the enchantment set hits, I got in a lot. I was surprised.
Yeah, I don't know what enchantment removal people are going to opt to play. Because, you know, I was even thinking about this playing through my games earlier in the early release event, is that even in Gruul, I'm like, well, I just have to main deck Thrashing Bronodons now. Like, because potentially that might be a creature kill card now. So I guess, you know what I mean? Like, I don't know what this looks like. But yeah, I think that card's cool. I would like to build around it. Like that almost made my build around list. But yeah, I would like to see somebody play with it and just go off with that card. I think it could be really, really, really neat.
Yeah, when it wins, you know, when it wins, it's going to steamroll. Now, yeah, when you lock up and you don't actually get your enchantment, you run to somebody that actually runs enchantment removal. Yeah, that's a thing, but it's good matchups. I think you're going to be really good.
Now, the last card I have in this category is, well, I will start by saying this card likely is never going to be more than like a 25-cent rare.
I like it already.
But Allure of the Unknown. It's a 3-colorless black-red sorcery. Reveal the top 6 cards of your library. An opponent exiles a non-land card from among them. Then you put the rest into your hand. That opponent may cast the exiled card without paying its mana cost. So the interesting thing about this card is that on the one hand, from a constructed just 60 card standpoint, I kind of like don't generally like cards like this, because it's kind of like, okay, I'm going to reveal 6 cards. Let's say 3 or 4 of them are spells. So I'm really only going to get like maybe 2 relevant cards. If I'm lucky, 3, but my opponent's going to get the best of them. So what am I really getting out of this exchange? But yeah, the trade-off is if I find a way to play this in a combo-based sort of deck, they can take away one piece, but I can still normally use the other pieces. Because a lot of times, combo decks are built on redundancy, drawing extra cards, getting multiple things out of your graveyard, you know, whatever it is the deck's trying to do.
Multiple triggers going off at the same time.
Yeah, exactly. So you may still be getting benefit off it, which is pretty cool. Like, I like things like that that give you those opportunities. But I started thinking, how does this play in a commander setting? Because, you know, there's times where I might go, okay, I might choose you to be the opponent that gets to play the card. So we technically get to play more spells this turn against a problematic opponent, which is kind of cool, because you get to play the exile card for free. So I don't know.
It's fun being the guy at the commander table, like, hey, I can help you, you know, for the right price.
Well, yeah, that's what I'm saying. I think that's why where this card shines a little bit, right? It's okay, cool. I will let you look at my top 6. You get to choose the best thing there to cast for you, but then I get all these other cards. It could be extra cards to just put creatures into play to do something. Like, there's a bunch of things that could come of those, I guess, 5 cards that you'll be getting. And, you know, paying 5 to get 5 cards isn't junk, you know?
No.
So, yeah, I don't know. I like I said, it's fun. I don't think it's ever going to be valuable, but I can see places where people would want to play that card, especially in the casual formats, which I'm okay with.
I feel like you've sold me.
Yeah, I said it's got uses. Now, how great those uses are, yeah, you know, I'm not gonna. If you put my feet to the fire, I just say don't play it. But if you find the spot where you want to play it, it's going to be pretty fun for you. Do you have anything else you want to add to that category, or do we get to go to our fun last card?
I think we can go to the last card.
All right. So here we each show just a single card that we most want to include in a deck. And I will say, I got to live this already earlier with this card.
So jealous.
But man, Clothis, God of Destiny.
Okay.
It was everything I wanted it to be. I mean, really, I'm not joking. And then some. So Clothis, God of Destiny is a colorless red-green legendary enchantment creature god, indestructible. As long as your devotion to red and green is less than 7, Clothis isn't a creature. At the beginning of your pre-combat main phase, exile target card from a graveyard. If it was a land, add a red or a green. Otherwise, gain 2, and your Clothis deals 2 damage to each opponent. So first off, it's very cheap. 3 mana. I might be the cheapest of the gods to get into play. So that part's good. And there's several scenarios where you actually have Clothis active and attacking on turn 5 for sure, but sometimes on turn 4. So that's also cool. But during the course of the game, I had Clothis in play. I have to tell you, I didn't realize, like, I had misread Clothis' text. I thought it was, for some reason, when I guess because it's a red-green card, and I assume you're playing aggro deck, that if you remove a creature card from a graveyard, then you gain 2, opponent loses 2. But it's not. It's just, if it's a land, you get mana. If it's anything else, you drain your opponent for 2.
Hell yeah.
And this was good because, like, it's one, it's automatic, so you don't have to spend anything for it. It removes cards, so you don't have to worry about escape. I think I actually got to remove a cat with it earlier because they blocked with the cat earlier. Then I played Clothis and got rid of one, which was awesome. It really adds some inevitability for the Gruul deck where you push really hard. You get your opponent to say like 8 and you're like, okay, well now I have to draw some big finisher. I have to get this big removal card. But you're still sitting there going, okay, cool. Well, next turn you're going to take 2. The next turn you're going to take 2. Next turn you're going to take 2. And then they're dead. And I won 2 games like that where opponent was at sub 10 life. And then I was still trying to like nick through for a point or two here or there. But there was one turn where I was like, well, I guess I'm going to attack because if you block something, I'm just going to get you for 2 next turn with Clothis when I add something to my graveyard. And that was it. Again, I don't know if this is the most powerful of the gods, but it's definitely filling a niche for those colors, especially since those colors don't have a lot to remove stuff from the graveyard to keep people from escaping things or whatever. This is one way you can do that for sure. And the card's good, man. I'm about it. Like, not only do I want to include this in a deck, I liked it, and I'm putting it in more decks.
There you go. It's a trip. It's got a funky beat, and we can bug out to it.
Exactly. I need one of them ghetto blasters with 16 batteries in it, 16D batteries, and to just carry around some cardboard and just write Clothis on it.
Those are the best.
Now, that's a reference. Now, granted, for those of you who don't get it, ask anybody you know that's north of probably 30, 35. They'll probably know about them big old, I call them stereos because that's what they were that we carried around. They weren't radios. They just had a ton of batteries.
And that's just how you roll.
You were playing KRS-One and you were looking for your buddy that bought the big pieces of cardboard they got from like a new refrigerator. And that's what you would break dance on just wherever.
And I recommend Dolomite because it was good. I'm going to recommend Breaking Two of the Electric Boogaloo just because it's Breaking Two of the Electric Boogaloo and you need to see it. That's all I can say.
But let's be real. When you go to watch Breaking, you have much lower expectations than you do to go watch Dolomite.
Yeah.
So yeah, what's your most important single card you want to build the deck around?
As I've mentioned previously many times, I love White Weenie, so I'm excited about it. I'm probably going to massacre her name. Taranika, or maybe it's Taranika, a Crowan veteran. I'm not up on my ancient Greek pronunciation, obviously. That's a 3-mana, 2 white. She's a legendary human soldier. She's got vigilance, and whenever she attacks, you get to untap another creature you control, and until end of the turn, that creature has 4/4 and is indestructible.
That's pretty good.
That's going to be some dumb combo stuff, I think. And again, it keeps with the theme of, hey, nothing in this deck wants to die. So I don't even know yet what her best combo partner is, but I mean, I'm going to find her one.
Well, what if I told you I have an answer for you?
Even better.
Because I forgot that I thought about this the other day when I was going through the set. But Swiftblade Vindicator from Guilds of Ravnica, it's a card I was thinking about for a while and never had a home for. But it's a red and a white, creature, human soldier, 1/1, double strike, vigilance, trample.
Okay.
If you were to attack with those, Swiftblade Vindicator gets untapped, becomes a 4/4, double strike, vigilance, trample.
I think that's a tinder match right there. I think we're swiping right on that.
With indestructible, because that's just what Taranika gives her.
I think we're swiping right on that one. I like it.
So yeah, just saying, that's an idea. I'm not, it may or may not be the best thing. I don't know, but that's just what I came up with at first thought. So
I also like her flavor text because she says, I like to think Kithion keeps watch over all of us. And like Gideon still, as far as we know, is dead, right?
To my knowledge, Gideon is staying dead. It sounds like they're going to give him the like Marvel Jean Grey treatment or whatever, where everybody's going to keep thinking you're coming back, but for now you're just dead.
Okay. I see. I thought with it being, you know, the Theros based block, maybe. Of course, they did just bring back Elspeth, so I guess it'd be kind of crazy to bring back, you know, two planeswalkers at the same time.
Yeah, I guess so. But yeah, I think it's just for impact and story purposes, we are just leaving Gideon dead for now.
Yeah. And in since you brought up, you know, the Jean Grey comparison, I do feel like some characters are better as almost that religious figure, you know, that people look up to.
Yeah, that's a good point, right? Because we don't, I mean, especially in terms of magic, we don't talk a lot about like that aspect of community being, you know, tribalism or religion or whatever. And there is something to that mentality, even within stories, right? Like having Gideon be this, I don't know if we want to call it like bigger than all type figure now for the people of Theros is kind of cool.
Like a saint, you know, basically, like he died in battle saving, you know, pretty much the entire multiverse. So.
Yeah, I mean, we took a character that by all intents and purposes was the least liked planeswalker. He didn't rate well with a lot of people. People didn't like a lot of his cards because some of them are really powerful. But in the end, you know, because of the way he died and the way the story was treated, people kind of have some extra respect for Gideon that we didn't have before. So maybe it's cool that he just stays dead. I'm okay with that.
Yeah.
And let's be honest, it's not like the card set of Theros Beyond Death is suffering without Gideon being in it. I mean, there's plenty here to be had.
While he may stay dead, everybody else come back.
That's true. That's true.
We got indestructible lions, for crying out loud. No one else is staying dead in this set.
But yeah, so that's our review. Those are the cards. Hopefully we got to talk about some different cards than you got to hear everybody else speculating on or talking about or rambling on about. Not that any of those other things are wrong. I just think everybody gave us the feedback that they wanted to hear our opinions on some different cards. So I think this was a way we could do that. And if you like it, let us know. If you hate it, let us know. So we know what we can do different next time, or if we want to do the same thing next time, or maybe do more categories. And we just pick one card for each category. I don't know. There's other things we could try. But I think that was good for a first attempt.
So if it was just meh for you, also let us know.
Yeah, that's true, too. If it was you were indifferent and, you know, you could care less about card reviews, that's fine, too. You can let us know. I'm fine with that. But yeah, that was good. I like it. Let's do it again sometime.
Definitely. In about 3 months, let's say.
Exactly. So tell everybody how they can find you, Brian.
Okay. I am, my media empire is growing. I am Alan's Ever After on YouTube. That's more of a family channel. So if you like, you know, kids playing and parenting stuff, I am DL Caesar on YouTube, Twitch, and Twitter. Those are my more nerdy endeavors.
And as usual, I am Power Dragon, PowerDragn, on just about all social media. So you can follow me over on Twitter, YouTube. If you search there, it comes up. And on Twitch, where we have now officially completed 60 consecutive days of streaming. And I am so proud of that, considering how difficult that was. Yeah, follow me on Twitch, though, because we will be announcing soon. Sometime over this weekend, I think we're going to try to do, if not over this weekend, it'd be early next week, that we're going to try to do a review of those 60 days. It comes with a bunch of tips and I think pitfalls people could avoid when streaming or trying to make a go of, I guess, gaming as a source of income. So I think that's it. So for now, we will catch y'all next time. Wherever you are listening from, whenever you're listening, good morning, good afternoon, good evening, and good night. If you have a chance, please check us out on Patreon at patreon.com/colorofmagic. You can also find us on Facebook at Color of Magic. We're also over on Twitter and Twitch at Color of MTG. And we have a website you can check out, colorofmtg.com. Please share our episode with your friends and help us grow our base. As always, every little bit helps, and we appreciate your support.